And tonight what's going to happen is a number of just sort of miscellaneous, just a few kind of miscellaneous proverbs, and then we'll get back into another section that will fall under a category, a grouping of similar passages. What is happening, and actually, is that I want to touch on every single verse in the entire book of Proverbs. But because we're so often going into a section that has them categorized, then of course we're doing a lot of skipping. And so when I finish a section like we did on the fool, I'll go back to the last place where I had everything, contiguous up to a point and we hit that first fool passage. Then I'll take the next few, that's the miscellaneous ones we'll look at tonight. Then we'll hit another group and we'll work with that for the rest of the evening. So I realize it might be a little confusing for you to know exactly how we're going through Proverbs. It's really not just straight through verse by verse, but there is some method to my madness, as they say. So here's a couple of verses, three sets, that they really say exactly the same thing or something very, very similar. And you'll notice that they're also very close. And with the first two, we'll be able to finish off now the 10th chapter. So we have 30 chapters. We will, as of tonight, have a third of the book covered, absolutely one after the other or as a block. And then actually we've got considerably more than that that we've looked at with these various other groupings too. So I can only kind of estimate right here, but I would guess that we're somewhere maybe around about halfway through the book. It doesn't look like it. It looks like we're only a third of the way through, but actually we've covered a good deal more than that. In chapter 10 then, at verses 24 and 25, you have this statement. What the wicked fears will come upon him, and the desire of the righteous will be granted. When the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Now skipping down to 28 and 29, the hope of the righteous is gladness, but the expectation of the wicked perishes. The way of the Lord is a stronghold to the upright, but ruin to the workers of iniquity. And then jumping into chapter 11 at verse 5, 6, and 7, the righteousness of the blameless will smooth his way, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright will deliver him, but the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. When a wicked man dies, his expectation will perish. Remember a moment ago we saw that perishing expectation. And the hope of strong men perishes. Well, one form or another, what they're all saying is that you will reap what you sow, and that you will bring upon yourself your own fears, the things you don't want to happen. If you're an evil person, they'll happen. You're going to have a harder time if, in fact, you choose this path. This story maybe you've been following in the news here the last few days, or maybe a couple of weeks even, I'm not sure. Well, it has to be a couple of weeks, because we had a murder. And I forget the state it was in now. And then a week or 10 days later, there was a husband and wife who got killed. And remember, they were both in the same county, weren't they, in some sort of justice system. And so, they knew each other and all of that, started putting it together. You hear that now they've arrested the husband and wife, and they're in jail, and one of them's confessed to it. So these three murders have all fallen out as a result of what? Who knows? Have you read the story? Guy got fired. What did he get fired for?
Theft.
What did he steal? Monitors. Not even home computers. They were computer monitors. And he wound up killing somebody for every one of those monitors. Just coincidentally, there were three monitors, and there were three deaths. Now, I say coincidentally, maybe they planned it that way. I don't know. But, the horror of this thing, you can't imagine. I mean, you really can't. A really good computer monitor is what, $400? What can you get out of them? $400 a piece? And now three people are dead. Well, when it started off, how big a deal was it? $1,200 worth of TV screens. Well, when it ended up, what is it? Three people dead. All of their families, relatives, and friends, are shattered. Now this couple is in jail. Their family and friends are all going to be shattered. And you just see devastation, as far as the eye can see, because of their setting out
sowing seeds that cause a harvest that's just horrible. And we would do well, brethren, we really would, to think in terms of evil as being a seed the same way the gospel is. Jesus used that illustration. Sower goes out to sow. But he also spoke about how that those good soils, will produce 30 and 60 and 100 fold. Remember that? In other words, each one of those seeds becomes something very, very much larger. So the same nature, but it's vastly larger. So you don't plant a seed, you get a whole lot more seeds back, you get a whole lot more grain back. When you plant evil, then what? It grows. You reap the harvest. You're really asking for it. If you're thinking in terms of just one little sin, one of my all-time favorite expressions, you know, the little white lie. I've yet to hear anybody speak of a big white lie. Apparently there's only one guy if they're white, and that's little. How is that? Okay. But are they? We have a whole section about speech in here. We found out about lies. We found out about slander. We found out about how devastating that is, how dangerous it is. We saw it as a separate section on its own. We saw it in the mouth of the fool as well. These things are dangerous. So again, let's just read those verses. They're really pretty self-explanatory. 24 and 25. What the wicked fears will come upon him, and the desire of the righteous will be granted. It works both ways. When the whirlwind passes, the wicked is no more, but the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Now, brother, I'm not sure at all that whirlwind has to do with tornadoes. My wife grew up in north central Oklahoma. They're right there, you know, your infamous Tornado Alley thing. She has stories to tell about running out to the cellar. You know, I've seen that cellar. They had houses destroyed, completely atomized, you know, within a mile of their place. And so, you know, they know what all that is. But if we're talking about an everlasting foundation, we're probably not talking about anything that's physical at all, are we? And so, in that verse 25, when the whirlwind passes, it's just trouble of any kind. But I think it actually could be up to and including the very judgment and final judgment of God, and the wicked is no more. But the righteous has an everlasting foundation. Righteous people lose their homes too, but they still have an everlasting foundation, don't they? Yes, they do. Then, in 28 and 29, the hope of the righteous is gladness, but the expectation of the wicked perishes. Our hope is for good things that bring us joy, and it will be realized. But the expectation of the wicked doesn't play out the way he wants to. The wicked thinks in terms, you know, of doing someone harm that he might profit. Is that going to work out? Not going to work out. And then the last three verses in 5 through 7. The righteousness of the blameless will smooth his way, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteousness of the upright will deliver them, but the treacherous will be caught by their own greed. When a wicked man dies, his expectation will perish, and the hope of strong men perishes. No matter how strong you are, no matter how smart you are, no matter how much money you have, if you're wicked, then what lies ahead throughout all of eternity? Not good. Not good at all. Don't put even one seed in one furrow in any field of wickedness. Too big a harvest. It's eternal. No need that. Now, let's turn to this next section, which will have, I think it's a total of 12 passages here. This time I didn't give you the whole list at the start, so you just follow through. I'd recommend you put them here in chapter 3, or if, again, it's too crowded because of all the notes we made in those earlier chapters, then you'll see one come up here in just a minute in chapter 10. And so we'll put it there, but we'll start with chapter 3 and verses 27 through 29. Solomon's got quite a bit to say, at least 12 different passages, and maybe more than that number of verses, to help us to relate to friends and neighbors. Now, in this case, what I've done here is to take every place where you have this word, Reah, in the Hebrew. I guess that's only Hebrew, but there's lots of computer programs and whatnot, you know, where you can do your study, go by numbers, and figure out where these are. There are actually other words for friends and neighbors, but in this case, it's the one Reah, which actually in one place, you may see in your translation, is translated lover, but not at all in the sense that we usually attach to that word. So we're going to deal with the people who are friends in your life, whether they're Christians or not, it's immaterial, whether they're serving God, you know, very overtly and eagerly or not, you know, doesn't matter. They might just be the next door neighbor. The word is translated that way too. And so it's just the people that you have a more regular association with. Pardon me. Get better at covering that microphone. I'm figuring that out, I think. Okay, so back to chapter 3. And verses 27 through 29. Now, before we do that, though, you know, it just leaps into my head. There was another announcement that I wanted to make. I'm going to show you how schizophrenic I am. I am going to start teaching a new class on Sunday afternoons that is going to be taking the time slot where we had the sign language class here not too long ago. Now, very successful that was. We were just immensely you know, appreciative of how many people turned out for that. Really hope that we'll have that many people that will turn out as well for this next class. That class will start not next Sunday because Mark will be here, but the Sunday after that. So on April 28th will be the first time that we're going to do that. And, you know, I haven't even thought about the time now. Should we start at 4 or 4:30? Did we talk about that? Are you Elder Flynn? Is it 4 or 4:30? 4 o'clock? Okay, 4 o'clock, and we'll have a good long break in between, you know, the assembly too, but starting at 4 o'clock, and all we're going to be working with is how to read the scriptures out loud, how to read publicly. Well, obviously, this will have a larger application to the men in the congregation. We're specifically thinking about those times when you are before the assembly. We are assembled for the purpose of giving glory to our God, and we want to do that the best we possibly can. And therefore, we want to get everything we can out of the scriptures. As I've been saying my whole preaching career, a scripture that is well read is half understood. If you just read it right, you may not have to go study in a bunch of commentaries, learn the Greek language or Hebrew either, you know, and march it off with all this stuff. If you just read it properly, you got it halfway understood right now. So we're strongly encouraging the elders and myself that you'll come and be a part of this. Now I want you to know that we're simultaneously going to be reading some material that is not Bible-oriented. We talked about this in our last business meeting. I was a little bit worried about trying to work, you know, with the scriptures in a manner that is probably going to be lighthearted on occasion. Mistakes are going to be made. I have no doubt we're going to be laughing. And so I just thought it would be better to get some uninspired material. We'll loosen ourselves up. We'll work with it. You know, the exercises. We'll not be using the Lord's Word like that. And then once we've got past that first part, then we'll come in and we'll take God's Word. We'll be reading through it. We'll do that reverentially. We will do that with the respect that it really deserves. But I'm very carefully picking the material that we're going to be reading. And I think you'll appreciate it if you'll come in. The material itself will be helpful in understanding principles that can and should be applied to Christians. So I'm taking the opportunity tonight, you know, to unveil all this, take the time out of our class and Proverbs, but I really strongly feel that everybody can profit from this. Now, in this process, only the men are going to be doing any reading. I am not going to have any objection to the ladies attending. And obviously, if you know, you want to drive two cars on these Sundays anyway. So, you know, come on down, be a part of it. You can help your husbands with this on the drive home. You know, and be a part of it, you know, more regularly there other than just in that class. So everybody's welcome. I think everybody will profit from it. Come be a part of the class starting this, not next Sunday, but the one after. You know, it'll develop our skills in reading and therefore interpreting the Lord's Word. Okay, sorry about that. A little bit of an advertisement there, an infomercial. So chapter 3 now, finally, in verse 27. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due, when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I'll give it, when you have it with you. Do not devise harm against your neighbor while he lives in security beside you. Now, any one of those three verses you could take by itself, and maybe even the last one, verse 29, is enough different from 27 and 28 that you should. But in some manner, probably a good idea, you know, to link, circle the verse numbers or something in your text, so that you do put these together, though. They are of a similar nature. So is verse 30, for that matter. Do not contend with a man without cause if he's done you no harm. Well, it didn't use that Hebrew word reah there, but it still has the same flavor. So you might go ahead and just put those four together. Now, I want to point out, though, brethren, in verse 27, in the first line, do not withhold good from those to whom it is what? To whom it is due. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. Did the Samaritan know that guy beaten up by the robbers?
No.
Did he owe him anything?
No.
Was it due?
No.
You notice there were a lot more said no the first time, and the next time you started catching on, didn't you? Well, of course it was due to him. When you owe everybody, you see in a circumstance like that. What happened in Boston? We got miles of video. And what did people do? Many people. Bombs went off. Limbs went off. Blood was everywhere. And what were people doing? Running over to help. You owe it to those people. And that's my point right here. Particularly in a wealthy system like ours, I think we tend to get to thinking in terms of my personal rights and what I own, you know, and that kind of thing. And we start getting kind of stingy is what I'm really afraid of. But we don't think we owe anybody anything, do we? I don't owe anybody anything. I mean, you heard that. Well, sure you do. So, owe no man anything except what? Love. And if you love your neighbor, well, now what? Sorry, Charlie, you got a lot of work to do. You owe him everything. And so you're getting pretty busy right here. And so this first part off the bat uses an expression of debt, of owing, of a responsibility that needs to be paid back. It's due. And if it's within your power to do it, do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I'll give it when you have it with you. Now that rest of that first verse and then the next one there doesn't seem to speak in terms of any kind of a debt. We're not talking about you borrowed money from the guy and now it's due. It's nothing like that at all, is it? No. If you have what somebody needs, then what? If they ask for you to go a mile, if they ask for your clothes, what was Jesus teaching? We got to get up and do good on this. We got to get up and get busy on this. Yesterday morning, I had breakfast with a longtime friend of mine, very knowledgeable Bible student, just a really superb Bible student. And he used a term I'd never heard before. And he said, there's this closed fist of truth. There are these things that you have to hold tight and you never let go. They are God's word, the truth, and you're going to defend those things and never let them go. And then there's this open hand of love and caring and giving and helping and serving that has to go together or you're not going to be a very decent Christian. Isn't that a great illustration? Oh, I love that. Now, this guy's not a preacher, not an elder, he's not a deacon, he's just a saint, he's just a Christian, but he's been thinking about it. He's one of the best Bible students I ever met. So, brethren, that's what this is all about. Hold that truth, fight for it, die for it if you have to. But don't be closed-fisted when it comes to your money. Okay? If you're holding your stuff like this, we got a problem, don't we? Whose stuff is it to begin with? It's God's and not ours. And we're stewards, and that's all. And so, you know, we better be faithful with that which is in others if we're going to receive what?
Salvation.
That which is our own, is the way the rest of the verse goes. But yeah, you know, salvation. And so what I think this is suggesting is that, hey, if you have a neighbor, then it's due, isn't it? And it's due without delay. Well, tomorrow, all smiles, we're friends, you know, and everything. Tomorrow I'll give it to you. No, you know, it's time to cross the fence and take care of it right there. Okay, then the next one here is in chapter 11. And by the way, I want to point out, I think you'll be seeing this later as we go on. Remember, and you all know this, but the 11, is that a chapter or a verse? It's a chapter, and then the colon tells you verses. If you have one verse, then it's one verse. In this case, it's 11:9. If you have a single F after it, what does that mean? And the following verse, the next single following verse, the adjacent verse and no more. Okay? And if you use that F, the whole idea is you need to read that next verse. The two verses go together. But I don't think I ever pointed out that when I do like this, 11:9, comma, and then 12, that's not saying that these verses go together the way that F does. In this case, I'm just saying in 11:9 and in 11:12, you have two different verses that say a similar idea, but it's not like you really need to keep them together as you would with that F. Now, if you see two Fs, what does that mean? 11:9 F. Following verses plural, two at least, so 10 and 11, F, 10 and 11, and as many more as you need to get to the end of the context as you're reading and realize that topic comes to an end. So it's open-ended if you see two F's. It's closed if you see one. Okay? So in chapter 11 and verse 9, first we'll look at that one, and we'll look at the similar but unrelated verse in verse 12. In verse 9, with his mouth, the godless man destroys his neighbor. But through knowledge, the righteous will be delivered. And this one seems to me to be written in such a manner that we're probably talking about those two neighbors right there. So it's with his mouth the godless man destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge the righteous, well, that's the guy that would have been destroyed, will be delivered. If the neighbor's not righteous, they'll be destroyed. But the righteous will be delivered. God is watching out for you. And again, the umpteenth time, you know, the caveat. Yes, there's many exceptions to this. Yes, there's injustice in the world. Yes, yes. You know, we understand all that. But he is telling us, generally, this is the way it works. If it doesn't work this way, it's not proof that God's word, you know, is false or shaky somehow. It only shows that God may have had other purposes here. You can still learn from this, and he still loves and is caring for you. So in 11:9, with his mouth, the godless man destroys his neighbor. But through knowledge, the righteous will be delivered. This is destruction by means of what? By means of words. Lips. This is slander. This is gossip. And it's horribly destructive. It's with this that a man destroys his neighbor. But through knowledge, the righteous will be delivered. If you have lived a life of righteousness, it will be known. And when people try to pick it apart and slander you, then what? You have openly and forthrightly lived a life of righteousness. When people try to slander you, folks will know that isn't so. That's just not so. Now, brethren, you know, preachers get slandered like everybody else. I have my fair share of that. Maybe I've given you this idea, you know, before, but again, it helps in this context. Whenever I'm attacked like this, and I've been said like this on more than one occasion, I always just stop and I remind myself, I made this up many years ago, Larry, those who know you know better. And those who don't know you don't matter. Okay? That's helped me a lot. It helped you too. So when I'm getting slandered, I'm getting chewed up, you know, somebody's all over my case, I know that my friends and my brethren, the people that know me, they understand this verse and they practice this verse, and that righteousness will deliver. The people that know me know better than to accept that kind of slander and that garbage. Okay? And those who don't know me, what do I care? So I'd be all upset because some guy pizzled me and wrote a nasty letter about me? It doesn't matter. You know, slanderers don't matter.
So, we've talked about this the whole series, you know, I think three classes we had on the tub there. But don't let this stuff get to you. Don't let it bother you. And remember, God does the delivering. Jesus took his fair share of abuse. So did the apostles. You're not above your master as a disciple. So, you know, get ready. This stuff is coming. Now, in verse 11:12, he who despises his neighbor lacks sense, but a man of understanding keeps silent. Now, you can see here, that's got nothing to do with gossip and slander like the other. So it's just comma and space, and then verse 12, and it just happened to be in the same chapter, not the same thing. But if you hate your neighbor, then who's got a problem? You have no sense. If you're mad at your neighbor, you have no sense. Who is the last person you'd want to have mad at you? The guy who watches you drive away every morning, and now he knows you're not there. How smart is this? Don't need this. I said, come on. You're trying to fortify and protect yourself and your family, you know, and the things that you own. If you care about this, hating your neighbor is really silly. And then it says, but a man of understanding keeps silent. Huh? Somebody explain that to me, please. It seems like the two don't even go together. What is that? All right, he who despises his neighbor lacks sense. But what has being quiet got to do with anything? Okay, Sabra?
It's non-antagonistic.
Amen. Carol, you have something to add to that?
Throwing branches back on your side that he pruned off your tree. It may
kick
you off down to your toenails, but...
Is it worth it? It's not. Now put these... Well, go ahead, Mike. We'll put them all in the pot there.
A man with understanding keeps silent. A man of understanding has his understanding to be keeping silent. He's listening to his voice.
Okay. In all these things, brethren, there's some kind of point of turmoil going on, isn't there? There's no problem with your neighbor. I love Carol's illustration, you know, the branches or whatever it is. You know, you got something going on there. And you're being wrong. Yeah.
What does a man of understanding do? Because he cares about protecting a relationship with his neighbors.
He's quiet. He doesn't start any gossip. He doesn't start any slander. He certainly doesn't start an argument or some kind of a fight. He's not going to create any kind of big problem right here. You can absorb a lot, you know, of irritation in the world if you just let yourself do it. He who despises his neighbor lacks sense. Brother, what happens shortly after you start hating somebody? If you despise somebody, is that mental or physical? Okay? You start despising somebody, though, you have a mental activity. What's next? You're going to go physical, aren't you? And typically, that starts with what part of the body? Your mouth. And then after you open your mouth, what happens next?
You start digging a bomb shelter. You know, because you started a war. Okay? So brother says, no!
A man of understanding, a wise individual, knows that if I allow myself to be angry, if I allow myself to get mad, if I allow myself to stew on this, if I get to the point that I despise my neighbor, that is senseless. It leads to a lot of problems.
And a man of understanding, he not only knows that, but he knows how to keep his lips tight. He knows how to be silent. He knows how to just absorb these blows and be done with it, because had to suffer that little bit of frustration by not being able to let it out, there's a whole lot less frustration than letting it out and declaring a war. So now you have all kinds of problems, and who knows where it's going to end. You know, you started this battle. You don't do it. Carol.
It's also not a matter of just keeping your mouth shut. It's a matter of being able to give it up, because you can let things, you know, shoot past that tree. It loops back through your head, and you have to keep yourself back down into submission, and because if you are thinking it, you're doing it.
Don, I'm just shopping for a house. You know that. Moved down here. We're in a rental. Rental will be up, you know, in August. And so we've been hunting around for a house. Above all else, what do I worry about the most? Who lives next door? Who lives the other next door? Who lives behind me? Who lives two doors down? I've been spying on potential neighbors like you wouldn't believe. Really have. I go up on that Google Earth satellite thing, and I study those houses. I want to know what's in the backyard of the guy two doors down. I really do. And I found several places, and I just thought, you know what? The rest of the neighborhood looks great. But I'm looking back over that fence line, and I'm thinking, I don't know. It just does not look like something I really want to tie into here. You know? And me, I'm just the kind of guy, you know, that after the real estate agent takes me down, takes me through the house, and we wave goodbye, and the real estate agent leaves. What do you suppose I might do next? There's a law that says I can't walk next door, knock on the door, and say, hi, I'm thinking about buying this house. Oh, you got those three pit bulls back in there.
Not really sure why that is. You know, so, rather than look, be careful. Then, be really careful. And then, be quiet and careful. And then, don't let it escalate. You'll be so sorry. Okay? Now, the next one, hit the down arrow key, is chapter 12. And down verse 26. The righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Now, see if you can just find one word that would then characterize what this wicked guy is like. The righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. I'll give you a one-word character trait for this wicked guy. Pardon me? Gossip would work. What else?
Deceptive.
Anybody else? Malicious. All these words work. But what you've got is that a wicked guy, when he's thinking about the neighbor, is thinking about what to the neighbor? Tripping him up somehow. Having an advantage over them. Taking something from them. They're all focused on some manner of doing harm to the other person. Usually, you know, to their own advantage. And now, you're just starting the war. My wife and I watched the strangest thing for years. We bought a property many, many years ago. And the next door neighbor had cut his in half, so he had two houses on it. Everybody else in the neighborhood only had one. This one had been grandfathered in. He had two places. He had lived in this trailer, and then he built a house down below. Now he was living in the house. He was getting on in years. So he sold the trailer. After we moved in, he sold that trailer. The guy that bought the trailer, he gets out there looking at this and thinking about this. He'd been living there, I think, 2 or 3 years. And he's like, huh. So he got his tape measure, and he found out that his trailer was 4 feet shorter than he had been told it was. He didn't have that much square footage at all. I know you're tempted to laugh, and I did too. You know, do some due diligence here, you know. Think about what you're doing. Okay, and then the next thing he discovered was he got to, you know, the neighbor that moved in, got to look in, and he thought, well, where's the well for the property down there? There's no public water system. And how come my electric bill is so big? Well, guess what?
There was only one well up on this property. And this guy had dug his trench and put his line down there, and he was using this guy's well that he had sold to him with a short trailer to pump his house full of water down below. Okay. Now, what should you do about that?
Call yourself stupid.
Call yourself stupid? What would most people do about that? Can you imagine how much Hatfield and McCoy this could become? Okay? But, whose fault is it? Now, I'm sorry, but this guy didn't pay much attention when he bought the place, did he? No! Finally, he sold it. And guess what? The next people found out. Okay? What they found out was, the property line was also about 20 feet too short. Okay. And so guess what happened when the guy that bought the house down below bought that house? He finds out that if the property line goes back where it belongs, he can't get in his garage. That's getting serious, isn't it? This is really serious. Man, we watched this go on for years over there. By the way, it's just so ironic. Guess what the name of the guy was who started all of this? His last name was Con. He conned these people out of all this stuff. But now, brethren, if you get into this, and let's suppose, so you sue, and so now you get some kind of reparation for the trailer, you force the guy to build a new well, and they did, and then you get your property back, and the guy down below who has now bought that property thinking it's bigger and gets it taken away, how's he feel when he can't use his garage anymore? Oh! Now what do you got? You've got a big decision, don't you? What should that decision be based on? Make peace. Make peace any way you know how. Make peace if it is humanly possible. The righteous is a guide to his neighbor, even when you've already bought a problem. And the way of the wicked leads them astray. So you just banish all the temptation. I know there's a grievous lot of harm that's been done, and it's gotten pretty big and serious. But what should we be thinking in terms of if we want to be Solomonic? Making for peace, making for happy neighbors, working out a way to solve this problem somehow. Now, just so you know the end of the story, not that it matters for the are safe right here, but the guy who bought the property from the cons down below, he then died after this guy who had also bought the property later found out about the property line. So the day this guy died, this guy ran down there and tore out all of those pyramidalis trees that they thought was the borderline. He tore them all out, and he moved that fence down 20 feet, and he blocked that garage right off. So here came the young daughter of the guy who had just died, and she's just inherited a house that suddenly has no what? Garage. And she was real unhappy about it. But it wasn't her property. It really wasn't. But I thought it was good of this guy that he waited till the other guy died before he made any kind of a problem about that property line. But as soon as that guy died, he went down there and he took what he paid for, what was rightfully his. I can't fault him for that, can you? Made an awful problem for the daughter. But the daughter never lived there. She's inherited the thing after her dad. I'm sorry the property she inherited now hasn't got as much value, but you've got to be pretty impressed with that neighbor who didn't do that until the other guy passed away. He lived without that property all that time, years.
But if you let somebody use your land for 7 years,
yeah. There's got to be a proverb in here about that somewhere. That's right. Adverse possession and all that. At any rate, let's go on. Chapter 16, now in verse 29. Okay, 16:29. A man of violence entices his neighbor
and leads him in a way that is not good. Now, on this one, brethren, you know, it's pretty self-evident, and it's so much like the ones we just read that I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. But I would say this. If you're being enticed by your neighbor, what would this verse suggest you might become aware of? I want you to read this one kind of in reverse. You suspect that your neighbor's been kind of leading you on. He hasn't been entirely straight with you. He's enticing you somehow. And I don't know what it would be, but 10,000 illustrations you could give me probably, but what should you think? He's this kind of a guy. Then what? Okay, don't trust him, but what more? It's right there, it's staring at you right in the face. What might he be? A man of violence. A man of violence does this. But enticing your neighbor is not violent.
No, he's building an army.
Okay. The kind of a person that will behave as this, you know, deceiver and enticer is a violent person. This is only the low-grade activity where he's doing you harm. So if you decide you want to escalate the problem, what would you learn from this verse? Beg for violence? Is that smart? You may be facing more than you know here. You may be facing a violent God. Wait a minute. Okay? Now, in my neighborhood, that same property, we lived there for 23 years, and I'll tell you what, it was a saga. Okay. Now we go another generation, and another family bought the trailer up there. And they had the pit bulls, because they were growing the marijuana. Okay? And some of the neighbor kids knew about it. So one night when they were there, some of this guy's dope got stolen. He was an enticer kind of a guy. Okay? He's a drug dealer. He's an enticer kind of a guy. Alright? Now, the kids steal the dope. Guess what happened not too long later? We lived way out in the country. We lived on this crowned little two-lane road that on both sides had ditches so deep that, in one case, the drunk driver went down in one of them, and with the car down in the ditch, you could step straight off onto the roof of the car. How deep that thing was. You did not want to go down in there. No shoulder at all. And these teenagers were walking along that asphalt right there at the edge, coming home, and here came the guy next door. So you know what he did? He used his right rearview mirror and raked them off into the ditch. Raked both those boys into the ditch with a mirror on his car. Now, drug dealers entice people, but what was this he just did?
Violence.
That's violence. Okay? Now, who asked for it? Okay? But what I'm illustrating right here, brethren, there's a lot of wisdom in these proverbs. And if you'll sit and stew on them for a while, if you'll look at them and kind of reverse them and turn them upside down and inside out, you know, and think about what are the logical conclusions. And if it says this in the positive, well, what would happen in the negative? You know, work with it a little while. So I think what Solomon is saying, it has been his observation, that if you see this one, you'll see the other. But ordinarily, it doesn't start off in violence. It starts off with sneakiness and trying to take advantage of you. Well, as soon as you see that, you know you're dealing with a hard heart. How hard and to what extent it is hard, you're the one that may find out the hard way. And in violence. All right, the next one is 18. Got too many there. 18:24. Last verse of chapter 18. A man of many friends comes to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Raise your hand if you've ever had a friend that was closer to you than a family member. Well, it happens all the time, doesn't it? Solomon pointed out the obvious right there. Well, in a while, we're going to find out what to do about that, too. It's true and it's good. I mean, I've got the New American Standard, and it says this. A man of many friends comes to ruin, but it has a footnote that literally the word ruin, very literally translated, would be broken in pieces. A man of many friends is broken in pieces. No kidding. What translation is that? The New King James? You know, I'm going to have to go to work on that. I'm drawing a total blank. I'm very surprised. And it is a very, it's such a different, you know, idea that I just wasn't aware of it, so I have to look at that. Anybody have any comment or question on that? Jerry, have you come across that before? Yeah, go ahead.
Now, the margin in the New King James renders that may come to ruin rather than must himself be friendly. Rather, just may come to ruin.
Yeah.
So those are such divergent translations or renditions that it's hard to know.
Yeah, Eileen, we'll just have to go to work on that. You know, it's just such a dramatically different and unrelated way of translating that. I have no idea what happened there.
But anybody in the audience has a copy of the American Standard of 1901.
Anybody got an American Standard version from 1901? Okay, Bill?
He didn't make as many friends do it as to his own destruction.
Huh. Well, that's more like the ruin thing. I think we should throw Eileen out of the church. What do you think?
You just discovered that I'm in a tight end because apparently I turned the Bible on it.
My margin lists the abbreviations for the different manuscripts that translated the way that the American Standard does.
Okay. Does it show any other manuscripts in this other way, though?
Well, no. It translates. I've got the New King James like she does.
Okay.
There's just four different abbreviations of different manuscripts that translate it with the New American Standard.
Okay. Well, there's some kind of a textual issue there, you know, and I'm just not sure where it is. Yeah, Jimmy? Jimmy, I'm sorry, I can't hear. 17:17, a friend loves at all times and a brother is born for adversity. A friend who sticks closer than a brother. Yeah, they're recommending that because of the last part. The last part is so similar. I don't think, but it's going to help us over that front part. So, I can't tell you what. What was the translation again? Must himself be friendly? Is that how it went? Yes. Okay. We touched on this before, brethren, but I just want to mention it again. You will find very rarely in Scripture that you actually have a textual variant that variance. Okay, and this is apparently one. Go ahead. That's that 17:17 again, I think. Okay. I haven't done any of the textual study, but I just want to set everybody's mind at ease that on these very rare occasions where in a variety of ancient manuscripts we actually have a significant difference, as we apparently have right here. Okay. These are the kinds of things that the unbeliever jumps on and makes a big thing out of. You can't trust your Bible. You know, the whole thing is just useless. Now, in the first place, it is exceptionally rare. They have to look long and hard to find such an actual fact as we apparently have before us. But in the end, I ask you, which one of these two is true and the other is false? Well, they're both true. And that is the case when you have these variations. Now, 40 years I've been looking at it, I've been really deeply impressed with that fact. That even when you have a textual variant, both things are true. You never really have a problem with, well, one of these is an obvious mistake, and therefore now you can't trust anything else in the whole Bible. No, there is never a mistake anyway. There's only a difference here in how it should be translated. But there is no mistake. There's nothing untrustworthy or untrue, and we're still left with an absolute fact.
that would be taught somewhere else. Okay, Carol?
Aren't we really talking on this verse about the person who has no one but fair weather friends and doesn't have anybody who he can, who they can rely on, who they can trust their back to, or who will trust that they will tell them the truth? I mean, they're basically alone. They have all of these fair weather friends, but no true friends.
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know that I would take it quite that far, Carol. You know, that necessarily this is like a lonely person who hasn't got anybody to trust. It's something, the first part is, as I had it translated, is something we've touched on several times before in the Proverbs class, though. You've seen this before, that if you have a lot of friends, it's probably because you have money and you're able to give them gifts, you know, and that sort of thing. But fair weather, as you said, is what they are. In this case, comes to ruin. But there is a friend who sticks closer to the brother. In the end, you know, the idea is only that, if you have a lot of friends, you may not have really good friends there. You do want to have good friends. Take Rachel next.
That sounds to me like somebody must himself be friendly. Sounds to me like somebody who has to kind of have a face on all the time. Where you have to be friendly all the time, whereas if you have this true close friend, they can see you when you're sad and when you're not friendly.
That's a great point. I hope everybody was able to hear that. And must himself be friendly might suggest that he himself might be kind of shallow in courting people and, you know, not very sincere there. Bill?
I had a question on the second half of that verse. Where it says friend, there's a footnote that says lover.
Now, yeah.
Does that refer to a relationship like David and Jonathan or the other kind of lover?
Oh, it would be... the love that David and Jonathan had as friends, and that's why it's translated friends. But this is the place, I'm glad you mentioned it, where the second use of that word friend there is not this reality we've been talking about and could be translated lover, but as I say, it's not the idea we attach to it at all. Okay, I've got just a couple of minutes. Let me get at least one more, and that'll be half of the verses that are on this particular topic. In 21:10, chapter 21 and verse 10, the soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. Now again, this is just, you know, in the form of a warning and a description of an evil person. So find the wicked are like this, you know, they love evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. But once again, this is one of those where I would encourage you to meditate on that a little bit so that you then can be introspective about that, so that then you can apply this and ask yourself, how are you relating to your neighbor? And all of this, let me carry away by the sense right here. You know, we're not talking just about somebody who lives in proximity to you. It's just anybody that you're associating with. But if you can think of anybody for whom you don't have a kind word, you can't think of anything good about them. What your parents said, you know, no doubt when you were a child, can't say anything good, don't say anything at all. But think about this 21:10 for a second. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor, the wicked soul who desires evil, his neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. So if I ask myself, I have some acquaintance, friend, neighbor, whatever, that finds no favor in my eyes. What have I just described myself to be in the first part of the verse? The soul of a wicked one who desires evil. So be careful, brethren, because you will also have people mistreat you in your life. And if you haven't already had a friend betray you, well, get ready. Jesus wasn't the first and the last. Get ready. And then when this happens, learn to be forgiving and forgetful and learn to find good and try, you know, to get over this thing. Because there's a sore temptation here, and that temptation is to the destruction of your own character. Okay? Michael, do you have a hand up?
I've kind of always thought that if you don't get yourself ready for people to disappoint you, that you're going to be disappointed.
I like that. Yeah, life is like that. It's just, you know, it's coming.
Okay, we'll close there. Does anybody else have a comment or question? Jerry, you got one?
Go ahead.
That all of those references that are given there that will render this, the man may, may come to ruin from the Syriac, the Targum, the Vulgate, or the Masoretic text.
Those are the ones that Greg must have had notated in his.
Yeah. And in defense of the King James translation, none of those are major manuscripts, and some are themselves copies. So.
Yeah, okay, there you are. An alternate reading then that's in a few manuscripts which are also in what we call family. And that means that you have four or five manuscripts, but you can also tell that these two or three were copied from the original ones. So they're just carrying on something that happened right there. Okay? So what I'm going to do is look over Frank at Lenny and ask Frank to lead us in the final prayer.